To see examples of what we talked about on this episode, along with further information, go to bunchofdorks.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to
Two Dimension Podcast,
the comic book podcast
with no direction.
Hey guys, this is Dallas. Let's talk about nostalgia. Two Dimension has always been different from other podcasts. Okay, sure, we do talk about new books and the current state of the industry, but we don't dwell on it. Our focus is, and has always been, the history of the medium and how it has affected our lives. All four of us in the show have grown up reading comics. We started when we were kids. We continue to read as adults. But it was those formative years that made an impact on us. Whether it was superheroes, Disney characters, or whatever, these comics help make us the people that we are. So here in the show, we often look at old books through rose-colored glasses, and I think that's healthy. And what's more, I consider us a kind of refuge from the modern world. Considering the state of American bipartisan politics, it's sometimes hard for me, at least, to get out of bed in the morning. So a nice escape from time to time is good for all of us. Recently, I visited Washington, D.C. with my wife and my daughter. It was easy to get caught up in the grim realities of the political landscape there. When we walked past the White House, there were people screaming and just general animosity. I'm not here to talk politics. I'm not here to pick sides, but I want to express my two-year-old daughter's viewpoint. Throughout our trip to D.C., she was wide-eyed. She was seeing the Lincoln Monument for the first time. She was excited and even in awe of the things she was seeing. She saw past the rude people, the screaming, and all the cars that were honking, and she just really enjoyed the city. This is something I hope she'll grow up to remember and to value. And this reminds me of our early experiences with comic books. It was about the excitement of the characters and the stories, the superheroes that jumped off the page and into our imaginations. There was no judgment from us or no dissatisfaction on how these characters were handled. We were dazzled. This is something that we try earnestly to express on our show. What's great is the four of us come from different backgrounds, and we read different books, but it's our shared love of the medium that brought us together. You can hear that passion in Rook's voice, in Don's voice, and in Al's voice. I've learned more about comics since we started this podcast than I have in my entire life, and that's thanks to all of us sharing our experiences and sharing our excitement with each other. There's a place for criticism when it comes to art, and it's very important, and it's crucial for growth, and we do engage in that, but somehow we've always been able to keep that childlike wonder of comic books. Because it's important to us, and we want to pass that excitement on to other people, because positivity is contagious. And so, without further ado...
My name's Don, and you are...
Al.
And we have...
The exact moment that we come out, somebody's calling me, but they're going to have to wait.
Oh, you want to
start
again?
Until the show's over.
You want to start again?
Because that's no business.
All right. Well, I was going to say, I had a couple of quotes here, but I kind of blew it, but I'm going to read them anyway.
Okay.
I have two. The first one, a man that knows nothing of the issues and suspects even less.
Okay? Okay. All right.
Or...
Okay.
Or... A man who struggles for reason and order in a world with none.
That's more, the second one. Yeah,
well,
that's me.
The second one sounds a lot better.
Yeah, the second one's better.
But
yeah, I like that.
They both sound like kind of the same thing. It's just the second one sounds nicer.
It sounds nicer. It sounds, I can understand it better. Yeah, that's me. Yeah, that is a, I don't know what the right word is right now, but that is a conundrum. I don't know if that's the right word, to struggle for reason. Because it's like, you know, a lot of things don't make any sense, but, you know, that's like deep thoughts. You
that's
know?
Why
that's
we have philosophers.
We're about here.
That's
we're
we
about mainstream comic book entertainment and minimal deep thoughts. So anyway, yeah. So we're here, and we're here to talk about comic books and other stuff. So, you know. So what do you got, man? You start. What do you got? What do you got?
All right, well, I sent you a page. I've been reading.
Yeah, I was wondering what the deal was with that.
Right.
It's from Doctor Strange.
Yeah, I've talked about this on the show before. I'm a big fan of Steve Ditko's Doctor Strange. I've liked Doctor Strange and other people did him. But I found these Doctor Strange classics. They were printed in 1984.
Yeah.
Remember Marvel in like 82 to 84, they were taking like the Adam Warlock run that Jim Starlin did.
Yep.
Remember they did that in six you know, reprint books with wraparound covers?
Yep.
And they did Steranko's Captain America. You know, they did stuff like that. You'd pick them up. And a lot of times with us, they were the only chance they ever had to see it. You know, yeah. I never had the back issues. But these are, they have wraparound covers.
Paul Smith?
No, it's John Byrne and Al Milgrom.
Huh.
But John Byrne is doing a really serious Steve Ditko vibe.
Well, you know, he inked Ditko once on Charlton Bullseye fanzine.
Oh, yeah.
That's cool, one. Yeah.
The third one?
Yeah.
And the fourth one is the last one.
So those are all by Byrne, huh?
Yeah, and Al Milgrom.
Huh.
But I was overseas, I guess, when these came out, because I certainly would have bought them. Anyway, I found them. Again, big fan of Steve Ditko. The Doctor Strange stuff he did is some of my absolute favorite work he's done. They tried to... These are on that slick paper. But they tried to kind of follow the colors from the newsprint comics, but they came out a little different. And in the first story, Doctor Strange is undercover. That's the page I sent to you. And I looked it up on Strange Tales, where Doctor Strange is running in. And all I think when I see that page is Watchmen.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot about that. I was thinking more of like Mr. Abel Watchmen. Yeah, Rorschach.
Yeah. I saw that and I thought, wow. I mean, there are a couple of things. It's a guy, he's hiding. He's in hiding trying to, you know, get away. What this arc is Baron Mordo, you know, the Ancient One's original student, is the reason Stephen Strange became Doctor Strange. He teamed up with Dormammu. You know, I guess in a previous story, Dormammu, when Doctor Strange went over there and met Clea, he beat Dormammu, so Dormammu told him he won't invade our reality. And anyway, Dormammu gets around that by passing his power over to Baron Mordo to stop, you know, destroy Doctor Strange so he can go over and take over our reality. So that's what these four issues are from all these stories. I'm kind of surprised. I always say this as a kid when I picked up a Marvel comic, I didn't like the fact it was continued. It wasn't one story. And I mean, they were basically Doctor Strange as the backup story in Strange Tales. And it's a lot of different stories in this. It's a long running epic. But that's where he meets Eternity, which Steve Ditko had a really flexible imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And he can tell a story. I mean, it was, you know, just reading these books that were written when I was a small boy, I'm thinking, man, they still hold up. You know, it still keeps my interest up. One thing that surprised me looking through these is Steve Ditko was refining his style. You know, he had that kind of a narrow stick figure kind of look in his old stuff. But he started refining it to be more like, it was always Steve Ditko, but he had a slight Wally Wood and a slight John Romita kind of look without the slick finish. And then after he left Marvel, that kind of, he did it some in DC, but then after a while he got kind of stock poses and kind of, I don't know.
Well, after he left Marvel, I think it was after he left Marvel, he did some of his best work, I think, as far as artwork goes for Warren. He did them in washes, gray washes. It was detailed. It was beautiful. It was unbelievable. And did he do Blue Beetle after?
I'm not sure, because I always assumed it was after Spider-Man, but I've heard some
those
people...
Those are still really good.
Yeah, they are good, but some people say he was doing those while he was still at Marvel.
He might have been. He might have been. I'm not 100% sure. But I thought that stuff was still good, and I still think that Creeper was solid, and I think that Hawk and Dove was solid artwork. Yeah. I think it wasn't until the 70s where he became, you know, maybe he started to... you know, whatever the word is, you know, like streamline his style a little bit, you know, like Wood did. Yeah. But I think Wood in the 60s streamlined his style for the better, because it sure was cluttered back in the 50s, you know what I mean?
Well, he just, when I say streamline, I hate to say this, but lazy. Like, he wasn't trying to get better and refined. He just hit a point and stuck with it and actually kind of slipped back. Like, he was almost stream of consciousness. He was just, the first thing he put on paper is what stayed.
No, I never think about that. But I do think that Wood in the 60s did streamline his style for the better. I really do. He got to the point. If you look at the EC stuff, you see all this background clutter, and you're like, wow, that's really nice, but my eyes hurt, you know what I mean? But when he was doing the Thunder Agents, it was like, okay, that's good. He's figured it out.
Yeah, I agree with you. I completely agree
with you. Kirby did it too.
Yeah. Oh, you can go either way. Kirby absolutely did. And one guy on a friend of mine is on Facebook was posting some of the Fantastic Four, you know, pages he did with Joe Sinnott. And he made a comment that this is when he started getting more blunt. And he said, and you could tell Sinnott stopped making some corrections. Like, the fingers got more and more square. You know, everything was... What you know is Jack Kirby. And, I mean, he still had a refinement to it, but he slipped into that signature style. You know, instead of trying to draw a certain way and improve, he just kind of got comfortable with it. I guess that's it. He got comfortable with it and didn't try to change anymore. I think you're right. Steve Ditko was in the 70s is when I started noticing the change. But I'm looking through these, and... The ideas and the storytelling, it just, again, you know, he wrote these when I was like 4 years old. These is when they were published. And, you know, I'm nearing 60. And I can't wait every day to get these books and read part of it. You know, they just kept me entwined.
Well, think about it this way. At the same time that you were looking at these advanced Fantastic Four comics, these advanced Doctor Stranges, you're listening to this advanced Beatles music around 66, 67, yeah. Revolver, Sgt. Pepper. You're like a little kid listening to this stuff. Of course your mind's going to expand without psychedelics, and of course you're going to, like, you know, want more and more out of your, because we were exposed to all this, like, incredible pop culture at a really early age, you know? So that's why I'm into all this weird music and all this art and all this stuff, because we got, like, the best. I mean, I guess every generation says it, but I truly believe that in the 60s and the 70s, we got the best of comic books. I truly believe that.
Well, you know, I think so. I think this great stuff that's come later has just been unbelievable. But for kids, yeah. I mean, when I say kids, I'm talking about up to teenagers and college age, you know. There was primal rawness to it, and I'm shocked that there was a lot of great creators, but Kirby and Ditko was just unbelievable.
I mean, they were geniuses.
And the one thing that got me, I've seen the character of Eternity, you know, especially in the 70s and 80s, whenever they draw anything in Doctor Strange, you'd always have Dormammu, you know, have Baron Mordo, they'd have Nightmare, they'd have or was it Eternity all the time? Neat looking drawing. But I've never actually read where he found him. Mordo's taken over, he's got all his power. the Ancient One goes into coma. They hide him, you know, in this cave somewhere. Doctor Strange is hiding. All these spirits are chasing him. And while this is going on, the only thing the Ancient One can say when he comes out of the coma is, "Too much power, find eternity." Doctor Strange has no clue what that is, and of course he can't talk to Ancient whenever he tries to find out. And nobody else he finds seems to know what this is. And it's, I'll post the page, you know, a couple of pages on the blog. It's just neat how he uses his amulet to find him. You know, he gets some instructions, and he has his amulet that he's had it every time. The amulet grows bigger, the eye opens up, and he walks through it. And I never thought of that. I don't know, it's just neat. And then, when eternity does show up, it seemed animated to me, even though he was just drawing it. And, you know, he's just on a few pages. You know, reading this now and knowing all these characters, I can't imagine what that was like back in 65, you know, reading this stuff, thinking, wait a minute, what? You could disappear.
Oh, yeah.
Stuff.
I mean, the thing about it, too, is, in my opinion, anyway, it was, well, at least we know that Doctor Strange was Steve Ditko's idea, because Stan said it in a letter. So you can't blame, he didn't. You know, hog that one. He says, "'Twas Steve's idea to do this." So it's a Steve Ditko deal or whatever. But, you know, sometimes for a kid, it might have been a little too much. You know what I mean? It was a little too cerebral maybe, which would probably be more Ditko than Stan Lee or anything like that. But I do have a fondness for the Gene Colan Doctor Strange stories too, especially the ones where he wore a mask. I do have a fondness for those. Those are really strange.
You and I talked about it in one of the older episodes.
We did. I like those.
I wasn't a fan of the mask. I didn't hate it, but I don't know. It kind of, to me, turned him into a superhero instead of what he was.
Yeah, it was just different. You know, I was like, you know, oh, okay, wow, this looks kind of cool. All right, you know, and then it went back to good old Doctor Strange after that. Was he canceled for a while, I think?
Well, he was in Strange Tales.
Yeah, but Strange Tales ended.
But then he was in, because there was a cover I saw when I was in high school that I wanted. Terry Austin drew it. And it was Doctor Strange. It looked like he was in Central Park, and there was a man and woman, you know, wearing, you know, suits. You know, suit and a business attire. And kind of disco-looking people. And they're shooting beams at him, and he's deflecting them in Central Park. I thought, wow, I wanted it just for the cover, but I didn't like the interior, so I didn't want to buy it. But it wasn't, I looked this up online. It wasn't Doctor Strange. I can't remember what it was called. But then he did get his own magazine sometime in the 80s, I think.
Yeah, he was on hiatus for a little while.
But I can't stress to you, in, I guess it was 82, that's when the Doctor Strange comic, Roger Stern and Frank Miller were supposed to do it, and there was house ads in Marvel Comics saying, you know, it had a drawing of Doctor Strange Frank Miller drew. This is before he got famous on Daredevil. I guess he was doing Daredevil, but the book never came out. They never did it. But then after that, it seemed like all the plugs just came out because Michael Golden did an issue, you know, which was staggering.
Yeah, I remember that, yeah. And he was in, I think, some of the, like you said, some of the magazines. He might have had some stories in them too, but he's always been kind of like, he got a movie, a couple of movies, so I can't say he's like a second-tier guy, but he was never like, you know, oh my, everybody was clamoring for Doctor Strange. He was interesting. He was an interesting character. Yeah. So I always wondered what prompted Steve Ditko, because he never, to want to do that, because he never talked about mysticism as far as I know, but he must have been reading up on some weird stuff to get that, you know, to get all those ideas and all those concepts through, you know, like into some weird, you know, Indian mysticism or some magic or something like that. But he never really talked about it.
I think he just used that as a storytelling device because, you know, the magic in Doctor Strange, it's not really like based off of religion, even though he shows a lot of Eastern images and stuff and this and that. It's what people call comic book hokey. You know, I guess if you found somebody that was really into some, you know, one of these beliefs, you know, they'd say, oh, you read too many comics. I think he just used that just to draw stories, you know.
It's very possible, you know, but it was so well thought out, you know, that you wonder whether or not there was something else going on there. But, well, like you said, once he never really talked about it, you know, he never really did anything. Well, did he ever do anything like that again? I don't think so. Did he?
Well, Shade the Changing Man was science.
Shade the Changing Man was similar? Okay.
Well, thought so, because remember Shade had that force field that distorted his body. He had like a big arm and a big side of his face, and the Creeper, I never read these. Whenever I saw it, they had all those curly smoke, you know, going behind it, and I don't really know
much. The question. Yeah, you know, but that was an offshoot of, that was pre Mr. A. It's funny how he was doing Doctor Strange. Well, Doctor Strange was earlier, and then like a year or two later he's doing like the complete opposite of Doctor Strange, Mr. A, which is, you know, a completely different character. Ditko definitely had a split personality or something going on.
I just think he was just
creative.
I think he just created ever enticing stories. I like Doctor Strange, and you know, that's something I think about a lot. We're going back to Howard Chaykin. I really liked American Flag, you know, that comic book he did in the early 80s for First Comics. It was, to me, one of the best. It's still some of my favorite work he's done. And then after a while, the book went on, and I bought them, but I didn't enjoy them anywhere near as much. And I found out, like, after the 12th issue, he started bringing in other people to do the book. He was kind of overseeing it. You know, I don't know if they were finishing what he was doing, but as time went on, he wasn't really doing anything at all except maybe covers. And I just stopped buying it. And then they made a big deal that he was going to come back to it and retool it. And I can't think of that man's name. He was a creator that I did like. I bought some of his books. He was doing American Flag, but it was kind of assisting Howard Chaykin. ElfQuest was another one. I loved ElfQuest in the 70s, you know, all the way up to the mid, early 80s. And I guess it was in the 90s. They decided once they got the book going again, they were going to bring in other people to do it. And what they referred to was Jack Kirby did all the Marvel books, but then John Buscema and all these other people come in to take them. And, you know, the Pennies, they met through the Silver Surfer letters page, you know. And I guess they were thinking, like Howard Chaykin was thinking, was other people can do your books. Not to me, you know. Well, like I said, talking about Doctor Strange, absolutely, it's a signature of Steve Ditko. Those old stories, that's the ones I always refer back to. But in the early 80s, you know, after Michael Golden did that one issue, Marshall Rogers did about three or four really nice issues.
Yeah.
Paul Smith did some. And then Carl Potts took over as the I think he took over the editor.
And it is. How popular an issue.
Yeah, a fantastic issue. Then I got Tony Salmons to do one of my favorite issues ever of any comic. They had, Steve Laiolola did a few. But
yeah. And Gene Colan came back and did some too.
Yeah, but I love, the stories were neat. And a lot of them were just standalone stories. Some of them continued. The Steve Laiolola stories were basically he stopped Dracula. They destroyed Dracula.
Yeah.
But there is something about some of these characters that, you know, other people could do and go on, and we love them. Batman, Superman, Fantastic Four. The Jack Kirby and Stan Lee work is second to none, but I enjoyed a lot of George Perez's run, you know, John Byrne's run. There was a lot of them I pick up, and, well, this is really fun, this is neat, you know, but there are some, again, American Flag, it didn't do it. ElfQuest, I didn't care for when other people did it.
Would you consider Doctor Strange a character? I guess at times he could have been a heroic character, a superhero, or was he just something different?
To me, I always considered him a superhero. I mean, he was one of the Marvel characters. He always teamed up with them. It was a different tool. Instead of science, it was magic. In Fantastic Four, whenever Reed Richards ran into something magic, he consulted Doctor Strange. You know, so...
And then they created a character in the X-Men called Magic.
Yeah.
Who had similar powers, I guess. Right? She could bring you into some world that she created and, like, destroy you or something. I don't know. I vaguely remember that character. I just remember having a conversation with a kid years ago at a comic shop and telling me, she's the strongest character in all the Marvel Universe. And I'm like, okay. If you say so.
We need to call Dallas real quick.
He knows all X-Men. Well, he'll talk about it next time or whatever.
Well,
but yeah.
There was
a 4-issue miniseries, I remember, that Buscema drew of Magic.
Yeah.
I don't even know if she's around anymore. I don't even know. Do they still publish Doctor Strange anymore? I don't even know.
Yes.
They do put out Doctor Strange.
Yeah.
Okay.
I buy them sometimes.
Okay.
The Magic character was Colossus' little sister.
That's right.
And I saw her. This is when Cockrum came back to X-Men. And I was kind of excited and was disappointed horrendously. But I picked up a couple of issues and read them. And like I said, she was a little girl. And then that 4-issue series came out with John Buscema. I bought the first issue. I didn't like it enough to buy the other ones. But I was told what happened was she basically went to this other world, and Kitty Pryde was a grown woman, and she had a cat's face and cat-like. I guess she was kind of a demon. And then next thing you know, she came back to the X-Men world. Colossus' little sister, and she was Kitty's age, you know, a teenager, and she had these powers. She could teleport to, I guess, to hell. She commanded all these demons, and whenever she had to activate her power, she'd get a sword in one hand, and then as time went on, every time she'd do this, I guess the sword had a glove, a gauntlet, and then, you know, it'd be her right arm would be armored, you know, but they always brought that up. Every time you call it up, you get a little bit more armor. I'm guessing before the whole run was finished, by the time she was 30, she probably had a full suit of armor. I don't know.
Was there a name like Ileana Rasputin?
Yeah, that's
like
it.
That?
Yeah, yeah. See, you're
lying. That's what I remember.
Yeah, you know more than I do.
That's what I remember. Yeah, Ileana Rasputin. Yeah, I don't even know if she's around anymore. She probably is, like, you know,
some form or another. That one guy.
You know. Doctor Strange is one of those weird characters. I remember the first issue that I bought was on a road trip back in 1970 or 71. My parents and I went to see my cousins. They lived near Disney World, so we drove up. And we visited for a couple of days, and on the way back, since it was like a 2-hour, maybe 3-hour drive, saw 7-Eleven. I told my dad, "Hey, could you stop there and get me some comics? I want to get some comics." So he gave me like 50 cents or whatever. So I found like an issue of Strange Tales from like 67. It was a Dan Adkins issue, and I freaked out because I was like, "Oh my god, this is actually a back issue. This is old. Oh my god!" So I remember very vividly buying that book, and like, you know, that and a few other ones. That one stuck on my mind, reading it on the way home. You know, I was like, yeah, okay. So I started buying Doctor Strange around that time. But earlier, Strange Tales was the thing in the Human Torch, right, or something like that.
Yeah,
and,
I think you're right.
Wasn't Doctor Strange?
Well, Strange Tales was from the '50s. I guess it's one of those.
It was one of those horror books, yeah, or mystery books, yeah.
It was before Marvel. I don't know if it was Atlas or Timely. But
yeah,
they
yeah.
had, what was it? They had Strange Tales. They had Tales
of Astonish. Journey to Mystery, Tales of Astonish.
And
all those guys.
But they were all like either giant monster comics, which were
no,
awesome.
Even before the giant monsters, they were like horror and mystery tales
yeah,
before
well,
giant monsters.
The other ones were kind of like Twilight Zone kind of tales. It made you think. And, you know, like that one guy was wanting to be a fighter, his dad was a boxer, and everybody says, you can't do it, kid, you know, just go away. But they'd always show the guy from behind. And then, finally, the whole thing, he took a bunch of, you know, prescription drugs and stuff, and alcohol, and they found him in his hotel room, seedy hotel room, and he's dead. It's this poor kid, he just wanted to be like his dad. He said, how can you be a boxer when you have a glass jaw? And the last panel was the guy there, and his jaw was glass. You could see everything inside the jaw. And I was like, I never forgot that. I read it in backup story. You know, it was a backup story in something else in the 70s. We talked about it on the past episode, but
yeah.
That was those kind of stories these guys are doing. If it wasn't the giant monster books, it was these Twilight
Zone. Shock ending. EC style stories.
You can all thank O. Henry for this stuff.
Yeah, some of my favorite stories are like that. Even though I know people that don't like that kind of stuff because it's like, well, once you read it, you already know the story. You want to read it again, but, you know, whatever. Mm. You know. But, you know, there was a prototype for Doctor Strange, I think, in the 50s called Dr. Druid, maybe, or something that Marvel did. Not as good, obviously, but there was a prototype for him back then. It's one of those Tales to Astonish books or something like that.
Dan Pritchard, you know, our friend from Australia, he was on episode 202. I always remember that number because Dan was on it. But Dan liked the Avengers. You know, he used to collect Avengers. He was getting rid of a lot of them. But he keeps going back to that, I think it was in 87. Walt Simonson was writing it for a while. But Dr. Druid was in the Avengers. And he just hated Dr. Druid. He just, he would get upset, you know. And I didn't care for the character myself, but I never read those books. But every time I see it, I just kind of, I'm not going to pick this up. But when Dan was talking about it, he and I would talk about it, you know, on Facebook and on his old podcast, Funny Comics, which we were all on at different times. I noticed, he was an old character from the 50s. I think Jack Kirby drew it.
Yep, you're right, he did.
And I brought that up to Dan, and Dan said, well, maybe he was a fine character, but it wasn't the same when he brought him back in Avengers. And one, he was all muscle-bound. You know how whenever, it didn't matter what the character was, they all had that same stock muscle body, you know, idealized muscle body. And But the Doctor Strange stories, they're just unique. And when I was getting those Fantastic Four Marvel Masterworks, I was wanting to get Steve Ditko's Doctor Strange work. And I found out those things are hard to find, and they're expensive. I've never seen one at any convention or anything. But the Doctor Strange Steve Ditko Marvel Masterwork is, well, I'm not going to pay that kind of money for it. And when I found this series, I thought it was all of them. I thought, it's just four issues, but it's just part of his run. You know. But I can't recommend Steve Ditko's Doctor Strange. And when I say this, Stan Lee just made it all better. You know, even though it gets wordy at times, it's just fun. The dialogue just really adds life to it. These are great imaginative tales. And everybody should be reading them. Besides Al and myself.
Well, speaking of like mysticism and magic and weirdness like that, on the last show we talked about, you mentioned, I forgot what your comment was, but it was something about a color.
Yeah, the quote, yeah.
Yeah, the color. I can't remember the quote, but it starts off on the, anyway. So we talked about the movie Die Monster Die, which is based on A Color Out of Space, which is Lovecraft, and you asked me about it, and I said I hadn't watched it in like years, so I actually went out and watched it, and I want to talk about it just a little bit because it's interesting what they did with this movie. Now, Lovecraft's been used in comic books. I'm guessing at this point now he might be public domain. I don't know, you know, but I know he's been used in some books. I mean, Tom Sutton did takes on Lovecraft without, you know, crediting him or whatever, or Lovecraftian monsters or whatever. But at any rate, basically, you know, we were talking about this movie, and it's an interesting movie in that, like, it's based on a Lovecraft book, but they just stole the story without giving any credit. You know what I mean? It was one of those, like, okay, it's not exactly the same story, but it's kind of like that story, the same idea, but we're not going to give the credit because we're like, you know, American International Pictures, and we, you know, and we don't have enough money, but we'll just do it anyway, and you guys can figure it out if you want. But it's an interesting movie because it's basically horror and sci-fi. You know, it's basically like the basic idea of it was like there's some kind of meteor came to Earth, and the meteor actually was able to, like, was found by a doctor, and it radiated, of course, and it changed, you know, it mutated things like animals and stuff like that. But it's all within the context of the movie, since it's a cheap movie, it's all kind of like shrouded and stuff like that, you know. But it's got Boris Karloff and Nick Adams and a British actress called Susan Farmer, and it was basically like, I didn't even know this, that American International Pictures had a British division, and that's where they did all those Edgar Allan Poe movies or whatever. Yeah. So it's basically, the storyline is Nick Adams goes to England because his girlfriend wants to see him, and basically Boris Karloff doesn't want him there, and then he starts finding out about the mother is like mutating and he can't see her, and it's just you'd have to, it's a short movie, you have to see it. It's kind of enjoyable because it's short, but it's an interesting concept. But from what I've read, it the basic idea of a color that can't be understood or seen is kind of glossed over in the movie. And it was written by a writer called Jerry Soule, who did a lot of science fiction novels, and he wrote some Star Trek episodes. So there you go. That's your little mini review of the movie. So it's funny because Nick Adams, it's like, kind of like a gothic movie, and it's all British actors, but Nick Adams sounds like Jimmy Cagney. I don't know. Do you know who Nick Adams is? Do you remember him from anything? From The Rebel, maybe, that Western? You ever see The Rebel on MeTV?
No.
You never saw it? I thought you watched all those Westerns on MeTV.
Yeah, I never saw The Rebel.
Oh, The Rebel, yeah. You know, he was basically a Confederate soldier that was, you know, running around or whatever, you know. But he was like a young guy, you know. Nick Adams, he was like a Jim Steen-ish guy or whatever, more New York or whatever. He was in Rebel Without a Cause.
And oh, yeah, I saw that one.
Stuff like that. He was in the Godzilla one. Not the Godzilla, the one with the two giant monsters fighting each other. What was it? Oh, man, I'm having a senior moment right now. War of the Gargantuas. You saw War of the Gargantuas, didn't you? Or no? The Toho movie, the Godzilla, War of the Gargantuas?
I might have and couldn't tell you. I love those movies, but I don't know the names of all the monsters, even though my nephews will be freaking out and want to kill me. But yeah. They're all... Here's something. The guy, my partner at work, I don't know why, one day he comes in with 10 DVDs, and they're all Godzilla movies. And I was excited. He goes, yeah, I figured you like them. And this is the guy whose band we play on the music break sometimes. And I'm like, yeah, I like Godzilla. So I watched them. Some of those were two movies, you know, on one disc. So I must have watched about 13 Godzilla movies. Some were old, some were newer, you know. Some were... They had computer animation on them, you know, which surprised me. But I've got one Godzilla movie. That's called Godzilla vs. King Kong. Was always my favorite one. And when I married my wife, she had two nephews, my nephews, that were 6 and 8. Godzilla freaks. I mean, they just loved it. They had a collection of them. Anytime Godzilla was on TV, they watched it. And I just told them, you know, King Kong and Godzilla have a movie. What? They were just couldn't believe it. So, yeah, it's my favorite one. Well, 2 years later, I go back to California, and we were talking, and somehow, yeah, we saw it. And you could tell they hated the movie, which, again, was my favorite. And it was just, I don't know, a few years ago, I was talking to my nephew, the youngest one, because we got to talk about Godzilla, as always. And when I brought that up, he said, Godzilla didn't win. And it's like the six-year-old kid just popped out of my 30-year-old nephew. Well, anyway, when I lent this to my guy I work with, Michael brought it back, said, oh, here's your movie. And he was the same way as my nephew. He said, you didn't like it? Godzilla didn't win. You're not going to beat King Kong. And he says, you know, and he's like, how can he not beat him? Godzilla has nuclear fire breath. I says, Michael, nuclear fire breath can't beat super monkey skin. And he's like, what? He says, it still sends the fur. Not on super monkey skin. Nothing beats super monkey skin. King Kong has heart. Godzilla's never going to beat him. Saying that, I'm the only person, I guess, on the planet that says that, because I think King Kong could beat him. And I think Godzilla's lucky to have a stalemate. But even my own daughter says Godzilla would beat him. No.
Well, you know what? I like that movie, but that was the ugliest King Kong.
Yes. And I liked, you gave me a copy of King Kong Escapes, which is a movie I remember with great fondness when I was a kid.
Yeah, yeah, I got that too. Yeah.
Robot King Kong, awesome. But yeah, it is an ugly, ugly King Kong.
The War of the Gargantuas, they kind of look like, they're uglier than King Kong, but they kind of look like, that movie was supposed to be a sequel to Frankenstein Conquers the World, also, I believe, with Nick Adams in it. And
oh.
That's right. Nick Adams was in Frankenstein Conquers the World. He wasn't in Gargantuas. Gargantuas was Russ Tamblyn, another 50s, you know, teen idol sort of guy or whatever. No, Nick Adams is Frankenstein Conquers the World, which as I said before, I saw as a kid at a movie theater with Tarzan and the Valley of Gold back in 65. But at any rate, yeah, Nick Adams is in that one. He was also in Godzilla versus Monster Zero, which but he always
came
out of place. He comes off as like a New York tough guy. And he's in Britain with all these British actors. Going back to Die Monster Die, he was a college student in America, and his girlfriend was British, and she went back home, and she called him back. She wanted to see him, and then he got involved in all this, you know, hocus pocus, like you said before, going on in the house or whatever, you know. But he always seemed out of place in these movies, but likable. When we do the post, you'll see pictures of Nick Adams, and you'll remember him. He died in 68. I think he committed, he OD'd or something like that. He died young.
Sorry,
you know, Russ Tamblyn, on the other hand, I believe is still alive today. You know, so good for him. Some of those teen idols from the 50s are still alive. Dean Stockwell, you know, Fonda. Dennis Hopper died. You know, Nicholson's still around, even though he wasn't a teen idol. You know, some of those guys are still around. But yeah. You know, that's the Die Monster Die mini review. It's all right. It's watchable. You're not going to get much out of it except for some fun Boris Karloff towards the end of his life. You know, 65, he died in 69, I think. So he's pretty old, but he's pretty cool. So there
cool.
You go. There's the color. I supposedly the book, the story, The Color Out of Space by Lovecraft was one of his favorite stories, books or whatever. So I checked that out. I recommend you check that out and then see the movie.
When we brought this up on the one that old episode, I, you know, posted links, and that's what I was reading. People said that was his favorite story was that one, but I guess the movie was loosely based off of it.
Very loosely. The concept is there. The concept is there. The idea that a meteorite came to Earth and landed there, and started radiating some, you know, the radiation came in and some of the animals got gigantic, and then, but some of the land died. And of course, when he shows, when Nick Adam shows up in England, he goes, yeah, I want to go to the house. I forgot what their name, the people's names were. Everybody, the townspeople are like, no, we won't rent you a car. We won't even rent you a bike. So dude has to walk to the house. Yeah, I was like, okay, it's one of those or whatever. All right, you know. But it's 65, so it's fun. It's fun watch. So there you go.
All right.
Read the book. I think it's been read. The Color Out of Space has been remade. I don't know the names of the movies right now, but I'll post them. I'll give you the links to them on for our blog.
Beautiful.
So there you go.
Let's have a music break.
You can hear our most recent 20 episodes on iTunes. If you would like to hear our older episodes, you can find them on our blog. Just go to bunchofdorks.com and click on the Cyclops.
Your Dimension can be found on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. If you like what you hear, you can subscribe, rate, leave a review, tell a friend, or like us on Facebook. Thanks for listening.
Well, all right. That was our music break for today, and that was the New York Dolls with Personality Crisis, produced by Todd Rundgren, of all people, who deserves to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame but didn't make it this year.
Todd Rundgren?
Yeah, that's a bummer, but Roxy Music did. But anyway, the New York Dolls were kind of like the first punk rock band, almost, kind of, sort of. You know, they were out of New York, 73. They kind of dressed up in drag, and they played nasty, loud, scuzzy rock and roll. And they kind of started that New York scene that the Ramones came out of, mm-hmm. and Talking Heads and Patti Smith and Blondie and Television and all that. So, influential band. I remember as a kid, I knew this kid in art class, and we were trading albums. I had some Beatles, and he had some Black Sabbath and Deep Purple, and he goes, you know, I heard some songs by this band, the New York Dolls, and they're really rocking, but I can't buy the album because they look like drag queens on the cover. I'm like, really? So then I went, of course, to the local Treasury store, which was a department store and supermarket in the back, kind of like the precursor to Walmart, and yeah, it's I wouldn't have bought that record either.
I
do like the music.
I see those guys. Covers. You've got to be kidding me. When I say this, they weren't even attractive. You know,
they're ugly as crap.
You know, I'm one of those guys. I never quite understood that, but
the freak show.
Yeah, but the Rolling Stones did it at times, and some people would always laugh. Say, hey, did you see that picture? But I think one of those guys in the New York Dolls, wasn't he that singer on Saturday Night Live, that Buster Poindexter?
Buster, yeah, David Johansen became Buster Poindexter for a little while. It had that hit Hot, Hot, Hot or whatever. Yeah, and, but, I mean, you know, the guitarist was good. Johnny Thunders was good. He passed away, too, of drugs, you know, obviously. And, yeah, they were a fun band. It was like back in 1973, everything was, like, heavy. And they were kind of like, you know, the Stones, but more raw, I guess is the way you would say it.
One thing about, like you said, influential, that's an understatement. Because I've never listened to New York Dolls. I never bought the record. But I hear references all the time, and they really brought on, they changed a lot of things and influenced a lot of things. To this day, I know their name, I know of them. A lot of people were trying to sound like them, and it wasn't just those bands that played the CBGBs. All the way up to now, I always hear references that, you know, they influenced this, they changed this. Extremely influential.
Well, they influenced they definitely influenced, you know, all the punk bands, and they influenced the Sex Pistols. They even say it.
Yeah.
You know, they I think towards the end of New York Dolls only lasted through, I don't know, 74 maybe. I think in 74 they were actually managed by Malcolm McLaren for a while, who was the manager of the Sex Pistols. So there's the connection right there. Yeah. Between those guys and those guys. It's weird music for 1973 when everybody was like, you know, macho guy. Well, I guess everybody was a macho guy. Robert Plant looked a little, you know, whatever. But everybody was like, you know, tough guy or whatever, you know. There's some weird stuff coming out of New York. But back then, music took chances. I don't know about these days, you know. I don't know. Maybe there is some cool stuff out there, but I don't hear too much of it anymore. Not that the New York Dolls got much airplay, because I don't remember ever hearing their records back in the old days on local radio stations where I lived anyway.
There's a lot
of
cool
stuff. So anyway, yeah, that's
the
New York Dolls. So back to comics now.
Oh, and one other thing, Todd Rundgren. It doesn't matter if you're not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. You're still awesome. And when I went to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Oh, you did go, that's right. Yeah,
it is awesome. And they had a whole section on Todd Rundgren. They had a whole thing about how he produced. They had Meat Loaf's Band Out of Hell. They had a lot of his solo albums. They had his band Utopia. But they had a whole thing all about Todd Rundgren in it. So even if you're not inducted into it, you'll be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And that's
yeah, but he got beat out by Janet Jackson. Really?
Listen, popularity contest, it doesn't matter, but they are covering this stuff because I really enjoyed that section. I've always liked Todd Rundgren.
You know, he I don't know if he bankrolled it, but I think he for Bat Out of Hell, I think he did the work for under, you know, I think he gets money from it because he recorded it on his own dime. So that's definitely like, I don't know if Todd still gets money for it or not, but it wouldn't have gotten made without him.
Yeah. He's done a lot of stuff. He's produced a lot of albums and helped other people out. He went on and on. He did the sound for Pee-wee's Playhouse.
That Saturday morning. He did. Him and Mark Mothersbaugh did, yeah. Music for Pee-wee's Playhouse, yeah.
But he was pioneered a lot of different things, a lot of different technologies, all kinds of stuff.
He was into video a lot in the early days.
He
and that band Utopia.
Yeah, I love them. I love some of Utopia's albums.
Some of it.
Yeah. You know, but
some of it's like a little weird. I remember back in the 70s and in concert, he was doing this kind of prog thing, and it was all instrumental, mostly instrumental. And it was a little too over the. I like the pop songs a little better.
You know, it's if you experiment, you know, people love experimentation, but sometimes you're not gonna like what comes out. That's okay too. But
yeah,
it just bites
anyway,
when you pay your full album price for something you don't like. Anyway,
so you got any more comics you want to talk about?
Well,
of course you do.
You caught me with my pants down, dude.
He's looking around now. Well, we can talk about some of the stuff that I got if you want.
Let's go.
All right. I had a couple of adventures with Amazon.com this week. Oh boy. Anyway, they're not horrible, but I ordered. I went to order a Mike Kaufman art book. It's called The Secret Sketchbooks. And it's a pretty good book. It was only like $12.95. It's got a lot of his, you know, unused things and, you know, doodles and stuff like that. It's a lot of fun. And I click on it, and all of a sudden I go to the, you know, to pay for it, and it says free shipping. I go, oh, I'll take it. Of course, free shipping means that you get a free trial of Amazon Prime for 30 days. Okay. There's a button on the bottom there that says you can cancel it. So I haven't canceled it yet, so I go, okay, give it to me. He says, we'll have it to you in 2 days. Great. Order it. I get it in 2 days. Fortunately, for some reason, Amazon on trade paperbacks, maybe it's just with me, maybe they don't like me. Other people I've heard that had the problems. They don't put a backing board. They don't put it in the cardboard protective box. They just put it in a envelope, one of those big manila envelopes or whatever. And of course, our lovely mailman folds it and puts it into the mailbox. He didn't really damage the book. It was just a little bent. But I decided to call Amazon. I said, hey, look, you know, I texted them, blah, blah, blah. They said, oh, we're sorry. We'll talk to the packing department. We'll give you a $5 rebate. I go, okay, no problem. I go, but you're going to fix this, right? Yeah, we're going to fix it. All right, great, great. Glad to hear it. So I get the bright idea. Hey, you know what? Like about 4 days later, let me look and see if there's something else that I want on here. So I grabbed another Mike Kaufman book just for fun called, what was it called? Fantasy, Secrets of Drawing Fantasy and Figures. I go, okay, I'll see. I want to see how this guy, his ideas of drawing are or whatever. Same thing. Click on it. 2 day shipping. They fold. They didn't put it in a protective anything. They didn't put to not bend on the manila envelope or whatever you want to call the envelopes, those big packing envelopes. They didn't put it in a cardboard box. The mailman bent it again. So I was like, great service. So I texted them back again, and they gave me like another $5 off. I'm like, all right. I told the girl, I go, if you don't fix this, I'm not ordering from you again. They're like, we're sorry, sir. We'll fix it, but I don't know, man. Have you had these kind of problems with them at all at any time? You know, and do you buy from Amazon at all?
It happened one time. I bought as everybody knows, here we go once again. I love Valerian. And those Valerian volumes, You know, I get through Amazon. Usually when I order, I get a few books, and they always send them in a box. But one time I ordered a Valerian album, and I ordered something else. It wasn't a book. And they sent them in a manila envelope. But the other one was like, oh, it was like in a box, a little square thing.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And it busted the spine. And the pages were all rippled. And first, I'm an easygoing person. I understand, you know, we're all human beings. And, you know, you make mistakes. I've done it. So I thought, well, all right, you know, I'll just put it in the bookcase and it'll flatten out. But, you know, when I'm trying to read it, I thought, no. So I just contacted Amazon and said, this was, you know, I sent it back. And I said, this thing was put in a manila envelope. And I says, it busted the spine and the pages are rippled. And I took pictures. And I just went through the instructions. They printed out a label. I put another package, and I just took it to, I think, the UPS store. I could drop it off there, no charge, and they sent it back. And then next time I ordered it, I just made sure I ordered it with a couple of other books, as I normally do, so I can get the free shipping. And it came fine. So, you know.
So if you order one trade, they're probably going to stick it in a manila envelope, and they're not going to put a backing on it or anything like that.
They did that to me when I did that. It wasn't just a trade, though. I got I don't remember what I bought. It was something small, you know, and it wasn't a book, so it was an odd package. You had this long, flat Valerian softback album, and then you had some square something in it, and you know, when it came in the mail, you know, like I said, the spine was busted, you know, and I mean, the pages, it looked like when you leave a book out in the moisture and it gets all rippled,
yeah.
You know, it was ruined. And so, like I said, there's no problem. If you want to send it back, you just return it, put the reason why. I took pictures, never needed to use them. But you can print out a label, you know, take it to the UPS store, and actually, I took it to the UPS store. They printed out the label and sent it back, no problem. So,
I mean, I kept them. They weren't. The secret sketchbooks has a little bit of a dent in the right upper corner, but I was like, I don't feel like going to send it back. So I just took their $5 off and said, okay, great, thanks. Thanks a lot for, you know, for doing it. And I said, I may never order another. And they was like, oh, we're sorry. We'll fix it. They're not going to fix it, obviously. You know. So yeah. I guess that the secret is to order more than one book.
Yeah, and at the same time, when you're talking to somebody there at Amazon and they say they're sorry, well, I know they are. But they're just somebody that works there,
yeah.
You know, and I mean, they're not in control of the company, you know.
Now my next step is to talk to the mailman and ask him to put it in front of my door as opposed to jam it in the mailbox. But he's tough to figure out when he shows up, you know. So I think he shows up around 4 or 5, so I'm going to be standing out there waiting for him to give him some crap or whatever, you know. But, it just seems to me like, you know, put some backing board on it. Put something. I do that all the time. At least do not bend.
I agree. I completely agree, but that's, you know.
That's life in the big city, I guess.
Well,
you know?
They're
first world problems.
Whenever I think of Amazon, I think of books. That's just how I think of it. But they're not just books. A lot of people buy a lot of stuff off Amazon. How many times have you done a Google search looking for, I mean, camping equipment, hiking equipment? You know, lumber. Amazon pops up.
Yeah, you can't find anything. You can't find media hardly anymore. We finally have, where I live now in Parts Unknown, I found a record store that says vinyl, so it's like, okay, we have a record store here. We have a couple of comic shops and Barnes & Noble, and that's it. That's it, pal. It's either Barnes & Noble or Amazon. That's it. You're not going to find anything anywhere else.
Here's what's strange,
you know?
Down
so
here.
That's the world we live in.
Down here, you know, as you remember, we had a Grindhouse video. And, you know, I follow him on Facebook. He always makes a video every few days. And he makes a joke. He calls it, we deal in dead media. You know, they sell Laserdisc, VHS, you know, but he includes DVDs in that. I understand they're going away, but I love DVDs. Over by my house, there's Sound Exchange, which is awesome. I took Myrna there, and Myrna was shocked. She bought a stack of DVDs. They're around.
You took Myrna to the Grindhouse?
No, not Grindhouse. The Sound Exchange. It's over by the
house. Oh, Sound Exchange, yeah. Grindhouse is a rough place, man.
No, it's not that rough. It's not.
It's got some weird videos on the shelves, let's put it that way.
Yeah, every time we went into that place, when it was in a little tiny building, which I loved, every time I go in, I was just going in because you wanted to go. You know, I thought, oh, I'm just going to stand around pestering this guy until I'll buy something. There's not one time I went in that man's store that I didn't come out with at least one DVD.
And you never went to the big one? He's got a bigger place.
Yeah, you and I went there.
Oh, yeah, you did. I thought you did, yeah.
Yeah, but, I mean, every time I went there, one time I went and I bought something. I said, well, there's a sale. If you buy two, you get a third free. And every time I walk around the store, I'm clicking my heels. I'm happy with what I got. I either find something I wanted or I find something I didn't know existed, but I needed it.
Yeah. Well, he does a mail order business too.
Yeah, and he was talking
from there,
about
so that's
that
how he probably makes, you know, extra money or whatever.
Well, he rents videos now.
Oh, he does.
Yeah, he was starting to do that when the last time we went to the store. But there's a lot of places around here. Bananas, you know, there's a bunch of stores that deal in, you know, what people call dead media, but there's the big following for it, you know.
Well, Bananas doesn't rent, though. They're selling.
No, they sell only.
Yeah, well, Bananas is considered like one of the top 20 record stores in the country. So, you know, they're definitely a, I mean, here, like I said, we've got some, I think it's called Vinyl Heaven. You know, the guy was nice. You know, they had $2 albums in the back and pricier ones in the front. So that was good. You know, I was... Yeah, they had DVDs, nothing that I wanted, but they had DVDs for like $3 or $4. So it's kind of like the same deal. You know, hopefully he succeeds, you know, in his little store there or whatever. I haven't been there in a couple of months, but I should go back. You know, I don't really feel like buying vinyl, but, you know, maybe there'll be something there, you know, that might be interesting. But yeah. But we have comic shops, so we're good at... We're good in comics here, you know, but,
That's a good thing.
Yeah. So anyway, let's see. Well, while you're looking for a book, let's see if I got... Well, I bought this, too. We were talking that I went to a little mini free, whatever you want to call it, free mini con or whatever nearby. It was actually really nearby, like 5 minutes away at this... the guy owns like a vaping store, but... I guess he owns the building connected to it, and it's probably the size of a convenience store or something. And he had a mini convention free; it was pretty packed. And you know, I found some like romance books for like $5, but I picked up the romance books for 50 cents. I should say they're pretty beat up, though. I found this 80-page giant of Justice League,
oh, yeah.
And that's always fun stuff. Yeah. You know, those old Mike Sikowski issues or whatever. You know, and it was $5, so I was like, "Yeah, I got to get that." You know, I loved these books, man. When I was a kid, you did too, right?
Yeah,
you used to
sure
buy
did.
These too, didn't
I
you?
I sure did.
There was so much great stuff in them, and it was a quarter. That's a quarter.
And the Mike Sikowski JLA, when I read them, it was in reprint books, like those 100-page super spectaculars. Mike Sikowski was doing Wonder Woman, the new Wonder Woman, you know, the Emma Peel Wonder Woman, when I was starting to read comics. You know, it's funny, I was listening to a comic podcast, possibly Word Balloon. I don't remember who it was on it, but they started talking about Ramona Freyden, who I love dearly. And he said, Ramona Freyden never drew Wonder Woman. And I thought, listen, the work she did was the work she should have been on. She did fantastic at it. And she wasn't, you know, a comic book person per se. But he kept saying, if he was in charge of DC, he says, Ramona Freyden would have been the artist on Wonder Woman. And he said, Ross Andrew shouldn't have done The Metal Men. I disagree, but...
Ross Andrew was great on The Metal Men.
Oh, absolutely. And he was great on Wonder Woman.
Yes.
But he said he would have put Ross Andrew on the JLA, which would have been great, too.
Yeah, sure, why not?
Ross Andrew was great at everything. I'm not kidding, because when I started reading Spider-Man, I'd read some of the Romita issues, but the one, when I started collecting Spider-Man, it was Ross Andrew. Ross Andrew, to me, is the Spider-Man artist, and a fantastic Spider-Man artist.
Really?
Yeah, he's my Spider-Man artist.
It's okay, it's your Spider-Man artist. Yeah,
I understand a lot of people did them, and I liked them. I like John Romita.
Steve Ditko.
Well, Steve Ditko was the man, but when I was reading Spider-Man and collecting them, Ross Andrew was the artist, and I loved him. While I'm reading these, I was shocked to find out that he drew Wonder Woman quite well, and The Metal Men second to none. And I kept thinking, what else can this guy do? Marines fighting dinosaurs?
Yep,
he did sure everything.
Did. He did the Suicide Squad, too, I think. The original Suicide Squad.
Every time you look up old Ross Andrew work, he was there. He was doing all of it, so...
He did the first Marvel-DC crossover, didn't he?
The first Marvel-DC crossover was Wizard of Oz.
That was the first one?
Yeah.
What was the crossover? Wizard of Oz? Why was the crossover?
They both produced it. I remember that was a shock. A friend of mine called me.
Oh.
It was when I was a kid. I said, what? Yeah, it's Wizard of Oz. Which is really disappointing. I want to say John Buscema or John Romita drew it. But, you know, I mean, I didn't really understand what that was about, but basically they used each other's production people and creative people. I don't know why they did that, but then, to me, the first real one was the Superman Spider-Man.
And that was Ross Andrew.
Yeah, and to me, that's his best work. He did so much good work, but that was just right up there.
Ross Andrew inked by Dick Giordano with assists by Neil Adams on some panels, I think.
Well, Neil Adams wasn't credited. Terry Austin and Steve Austin had worked on it, I think. But that was a thing I had read online. They asked Dick Giordano, because the rumor was that Neil Adams redrew all the heads of Superman, Clark Kent, Lois Lane, all the characters. And Nick Giordano did say, yeah, that's true. He says Neil would see Dick inking the pages of Continuity Associates. And he said Neil would just look through it, and the pages with those characters he'd take home and redraw the heads. And Dick didn't say anything. He let him do it. But Dick said when he inked the characters, he still tried to follow the Ross Andrew kind of flair to it. He tried to keep it as Ross Andrew as he could while using Neil's work. One thing I've heard a criticism about was Ross Andrew had a weird way of drawing people's heads. I guess the heads were bigger than what they were supposed to be.
Yeah, probably. I don't remember.
It worked on Ross Andrew's work. You know, but he said he was trying to still keep that Ross Andrew feel to it. I was shocked when I read that book, because it was Ross Andrew, but it was so much more. And then I heard John Romita did the same thing with the Spider-Man characters. He redrew their faces for all that stuff.
Well, Neil Adams was probably getting back at Al Plastina or whoever it was, because I remember him drawing some covers for DC in the mid-60s or 66, 60, whatever, 7. And you could tell they're Neil Adams, and Plastino would draw the Superman face over it. You know, I was like, oh, so.
Well, that was editorial.
Okay, whatever.
That was editorial doing. I guess if you got to protect a trademark, you're going to do all these things. But
yeah, and the Kirby stuff were like, you know, Murphy Anderson and Plastino would do Superman, and Jimmy Jimmy Olsen faces or whatever. Mm. I didn't really notice it when I was a kid, but I noticed it later on. It was pretty glaring.
Yeah, I didn't notice it when I was a kid. You know, when I found out, I was like, what? And I looked at, oh my God, how could you not know? But, you know.
And then, of course, the whole John Romita thing we've talked about before. Mm. that's an episode in itself. You know, I was like, yeah, okay. No. Whatever.
You know, like I said, there's reasons for things. I don't always subscribe to them, but yeah, Ross Andrew. How we get on Ross Andrew? Ross Andrew was the man, but
well, my first Spider-Man artist was John Romita. Those are the first ones that I bought, like in the mid '40s issues. In the mid '40s, John Romita and Jim Mooney, I think, was the anchor. I think he was the anchor. I don't know. I think so. Anyway, yeah, that was my guy that I started, and I loved those. And I thought they were cool, but it was like we talked about before, you know, it was like, in a way, it's like Spider-Man as Archie.
Yeah.
You know, it was like pretty girls, Spider-Man's like, you know, it's got that hair that doesn't move or whatever, you know, but I liked it. I liked it a lot. They introduced a lot of cool characters and all that stuff. I even remember buying that, remember the Spectacular Spider-Man, that magazine? Did you ever get that when you were a kid? That magazine they put out in 1970? It was a black and white Spider-Man book?
No.
You ever saw that? Oh, it was great. I think it was Jim Mooney. I don't know if Romita did layouts maybe, and Mooney did the finishes. It was fantastic. It was like a 48-page or whatever Spider-Man magazine and washes and stuff like that. And it was I remember buying it with my grandmother in downtown Miami at an outdoor newsstand that they had there. And I was like, oh my God, I got to get this. You know, so she gave me she gave me a big quarter, and I ended up buying this thing. And it was great stuff. It's been reprinted, but it was a fun story. But yeah, I mean, that's what I remember. And after that, I think I stopped buying Spider-Man right before Andrew, probably. You know, I didn't get the Punisher issues or, I think, oh, Gil Kane did a few issues too, I remember. I think I got those. Did you get the Gil Kane ones, the drug issues, and
no,
when they killed Gwen Stacy and
well,
stuff
like
that?
Well, that was in the Spider-Man comic, right? That was in the monthly comic, right?
Well, I couldn't hear you, man, so I'll turn the volume up a little bit.
The drug issues, Spider-Man drug issues, wasn't that in the monthly comic book?
That was in the monthly comic book. Didn't Gil Kane do it?
Yeah,
those are the Gil Kane issues. Those were good, too. That's when Spider-Man grew six arms.
Yeah, no, I had that. I love Gil Kane on Spider-Man. There was a
book.
But,
like, Ross Andrew came directly after that, or was it a couple of years after that?
Yeah,
do you remember exactly?
I think he came after Gil Kane.
He came right after Gil Kane,
yeah,
okay.
I think so. Don't quote me on it, but I think so.
Okay, yeah, I don't remember buying any of those on the stands, because that probably was not mine. I was probably buying, like, some of the DC Sword and Sorcery books and, you know, the Warren mags and the Famous Monsters and all that stuff. So I don't remember getting this. So I never got a chance to go out to the stands and buy Spider-Man and a Spider-Man buggy. I missed out on all that when
those.
I was a kid.
I had those, yeah. That was,
yeah, of course. You still have them, don't you?
I think so. That was the first two I got. I was on them. I was in seventh grade. And I remember the Spider-Man cartoon from '67. And there was a kid in school a year older than me. And he collected comics. And we were going on a trip to Pawnee, Oklahoma. And he said, are you going to bring some of your comic books? Yeah, I could. So I got a little bag and put some in. And he brought a stack. And that was so much fun. The whole drum section, we all read comic books and everybody brought some. And then he said, you want to trade a couple? And he brought a couple of Spider-Man issues because I said I like Spider-Man. And it was the two I traded was the Spider Buggy, you know, where they introduced that. I remember Hammerhead was the bad guy.
Oh, right? Hammerhead, yeah, I remember that.
And then the second one was when Dr. Octopus married Aunt May, which I found surreal, but they were both Ross Andrew. You know, I think Mike Esposito, but that's what got me reading Spider-Man all the time. I love those.
Dr. Octopus kind of had like a Mo Howard haircut, didn't he?
Yeah, he was. You know, my nephew was my nephew. Oh, this is he was still in high school. He liked Spider-Man, but then he started bagging on Mysterio. I said, Mysterio was a great character.
Yeah.
And he was just saying it made no sense because he had that dome. Which I do remember watching the cartoon and seeing Mysterio. I liked him. But even the cartoon, he had that kind of weird Mo Howard Beatles haircut. You know, and I'm saying that now, maybe it's not a big deal, but when I was a kid, all the men that age had slick back hair. You didn't wear a haircut like that. It was weird and unnerving. And he was such a vile, arrogant man. It made no sense. And then on the cartoon, he'd make all these weird things happen and had that dome on his head with that cape. And I'm like, it was uncomfortable. Saying that, he's a great visual character. He was just a great character. But when I was a kid, I hated him. But it wasn't a hate like I hate Darth Vader or something. It was like, who could hate Darth Vader? But it was an uncomfortable queasiness, you know, like, you know, stay away from me, you freak.
You know, I never, not until today, I think this is the first time you've made the connection between Mo Howard and the Beatles. I don't think that's ever been done before. I think this is a first. I think what we need to do, like, an image of Mo and maybe Ringo side by side. And
When I was a little kid, we talked about the Three Stooges. We didn't know their names. Well, you know, it was always the fat guy, the curly guy, and the beetle guy. We always referred to
them
as
the beetle guy.
But it wasn't great. Just me. This is in 67 to 69. It was me and all the kids in my neighborhood. We'd always refer to him as the beetle. And even though he didn't look as nice as the Beatles did, we always referred to him as the beetle. You know?
If I ever get a chance to interview Paul McCartney, which of course will never happen, I will ask him that. I go, I know you got those haircuts in Germany or in France or whatever, but did you realize the Mo Howard connection? And then, of course, the interview will end right there, and I'll be escorted out, you know, forcibly.
I don't know. He might say, no, I never thought that. Of course, he'd have an English accent.
I got to go now.
No, he wouldn't do that.
I never really thought about it, dude. I got to go now.
He'd just think, you know, you might want to talk about music instead of asking me these stupid questions, you know. But
Exactly. But I never made that connection. This is awesome. We'll have to do something about this. Anyway, I went to Ollie's a couple of weeks ago, and I picked up these. Remember these from the 80s, the Carmen Infantino, Bob Oxner, Supergirl?
In the 80s or 70s?
I think it was the 80s, wasn't it?
Bob Oxner did her in the 70s.
No, it's Carmen Infantino inked by Bob Oxner.
Oh, yeah, those were the 80s.
Maybe you're right. Maybe it is the 70s.
No, that was the 80s. Carmen did them in the 80s.
Okay, yeah. They had two volumes of these for like $5 each, so of course I had to snap them up. They're fun. I like them. I mean, Carmine did a lot of stuff after he, you know, whatever happened at DC, after he stopped becoming the editor-in-chief. And I remember getting these as a kid. Well, as a kid, I was already like in my 20s, you know, whatever, you know. But anyway, I found them there. It's fun stuff, you know. Not rocket science or anything like that. The artwork's nice. I mean, Infantino did a lot of work, and he got inked by a lot of people after he left DC. Almost like everybody in the business inked Infantino.
Carmen Infantino is one of my favorite artists. His work on Flash, second to none.
Beautiful.
I love
Murphy Anderson, beautiful.
I loved his Batman work, and I loved when he did Adam Strange for a little bit. And I just loved him. And then, you know, he took over DC as the publisher, and and then they fired him. Jeanette Kahn fired him when she took over DC, and he went to Marvel. And he drew Spider-Woman, who I thought was a stupid, stupid character. just explain it to me when I'm just telling you. Marvel did She-Hulk. Why are they doing She-Hulk? Ms. Marvel. Why are they doing Ms. Marvel? And then Spider-Woman. Oh, come on, really? Saying that? I did buy Ms. Marvel, which the whole time I thought it was stupid, I still bought it. And I bought Spider-Woman because the cover caught me. I think Dave Cockrum drew that first cover, or maybe
he did. Romita. He did.
And even though
Claremont worked on those too, I think.
Yeah, he came on later with Steve Laiolola.
Yeah.
But at the beginning, Carmine Infantino drew them, and I read them, and they changed the character because in the beginning she was in England, and her name was Jessica Drew. I guess it was always Jessica Drew, but she weirded people out. And they were trying to draw, write people with English accents. And all these people just found her creepy, as you would a spider. And then people would make that comment, says, yeah, these kids are saying we try to stay away from her because she's so creepy. And one guy says, Core. He says, she's so pretty, but creepy. Okay. But they tried to make this thing about that. And then she met a S.H.I.E.L.D. agent from Scotland Yard. Okay, yeah. I didn't think the stories were all that good, but I thought the character was visually neat. And but Carmine Infantino, he drew them, but the whole time I'm reading these, it's what we talked about in the beginning with Steve Ditko and even Jack Kirby. They were shorthanded. They weren't drawn like his old stuff. They were kind of loose and wispy and...
They're layouts.
Yeah, that was it. He was just doing layouts, and everybody looked windblown and twisted. It was basically, he was style, and that was it. I've heard, and I don't know if this is true, but I've heard that he got out of Pratt drawing all the time when he was, in charge of DC. And all of a sudden he was fired, and what was he going to do? He's got to draw comics again. Right? He's rusty. But, I mean, I say that, I find some of these old Marvel fanfares where he did a Doctor Strange story. I bought it. I looked through it. It wasn't his best work, but it didn't look like a guy phoning it in. It just looked like someone whose best work was behind him. But I bought
it. Yeah, you could do that for all the guys around that time, probably. Yeah.
I bought
He's Star-Lord also.
Did he?
Later issue of Star-Lord. He probably did it. He probably worked on everything. He worked for Warren. He was even inked by, Walt Simonson on a story about for Warren or whatever. He was inked by everybody. And these are nice. They're fun. They're simple. They're fun. I seem to remember, I'm not sure if there was a backup Lois Lane stories in these or not, but they're nice to look at. The Bob Ochsner inking is loose again, but it's fun. For $5, you can't go wrong. I think with Ollie's is I don't think they carry the same, DC and Marvel dumped a bunch of more trades on them, for cheap. So, I think each store probably has different things, but I keep going every week, and every week there's always something different. Not all of it is something that I want, but like I said, I remember buying these back in, I'll tell you what price they are. I think, let me find the cover on it. I don't know if these were 50 centers or, is there a price on there? 60 cents. That's got to be the 80s.
Yeah, well, I bought the first one that Infantino did when he brought Supergirl back. Supergirl never had her own title. She was always in Adventure Comics. Or she was a backup in Action. And then it was, I think, 82?
Yeah, you're probably right. Yeah,
I think it was 82 when they started the Supergirl comic, and Carmine Infantino was drawing it. I bought the first one. I remember she had a big red headband, and
yeah, it is right there.
It was kind of disco-y. I bought the first one, but I didn't like it as much, and I didn't read them. I mean, they weren't bad, but they just weren't.
Yeah, I think we hit upon something. A lot of the old. Artists or whatever, by maybe at a certain time in their career, they were just doing layouts, just to get the work done. I always think that it's possible that when these artists streamlined their styles is because they were doing other work besides comics. You know what I mean? It was like they were doing advertising maybe, or they were doing other things. So they basically, in order to get it done, they made it simpler. And, it was good enough, Also, in the case of Charlton, they were paying less, So the artist would say, well, you know what? I'm only getting paid half of what I did at Marvel, so I'm only going to put in half the time drawing this. You know, there's probably a lot of, or there was using assistants, possibly doing some of their stuff. I know Wood did. You know, I mean, most of Wally Wood stuff in the 80s or the 70s and 80s was like assistants drawing it and him inking it.
Yeah.
You remember those issues of Hercules that he inked, that it was drawn by Walt Simonson and Garcia Lopez and looked exactly like Wally Wood.
Yeah, and the Steve Ditko drawn Stalker that he inked, that, you know.
Those still look like Ditko.
They look like Ditko and they look like Wood. You know,
definitely Wally Wood inking, but that, and then there was that one issue of Sandman where he inked Kirby.
There's a difference, though. Like, you can draw simpler, but there's a difference between just phoning it in. I don't want to say these guys are phoning it in, but they weren't putting the same effort that they were putting when they were younger. An example, Alex Toth. Alex Toth drew simpler. He was always trying to strip things down, but I can't think of anything I ever saw where Alex Toth, you could see he was putting everything he had into it.
Right, but he was more of a designer in a lot of ways than a draftsman.
But Jaime Hernandez, same way. He started stripping away detail. Jaime just gets better. I've never seen him just do a lackluster.
Jaime was still pretty young, though.
Well, he's around 60, you know.
Is he that old now? But, I mean, okay. You know, I mean, these guys, I think that Wood and them and did Kirby, and they started, they started simplifying their style when they were probably in the late 50s, in their late 50s, early 60s, I would think.
But,
you know, I could be wrong on that. I don't know.
Mobius, same thing. Mobius started stripping down to a real simple, you know.
Did he really?
Line
okay.
weight. And, you know, you always get some people that really liked all the detail. Mobius is talking like all these other guys, is that you can hide a bad drawing with a lot of detail. It's hard just to draw a simple design that's pleasing, that's just a few line weights. Well, saying that, I've never been able to save a bad drawing from detail, you know, with detail, but I wasn't that level. But Mobius is stripping things down, and people will complain all the time. I loved it, but Mobius never stopped doing his best work. Even if it was simple, he was putting all the effort into it. But saying that, though, Jack Kirby was the same way. He was always putting, even though he got blunt, he was still putting effort into it. I guess it's just that sometimes I think you get comfortable. You just start laying a couple of, you know, things down and leaving it, you know, and then moving on. Saying that, going back to music, Elvis Presley, I was reading about him and the musicians he played with. They said that Elvis would do a song and they'd record it multiple times. He said sometimes up to 30, 40 times, 40 takes. And he said every single time he used the first or second take on the final track. But he said, when they play them, they say, well, let's work on this. We didn't get this right. He just keep doing it, doing it, doing it. And then finally he says, it didn't matter what the song was. I can guarantee you almost every time he chose the first or second track, every single time. Saying that, I think that's what these guys started doing. Instead of just working and working and working on one piece, just put the first couple of things down, you know, and leave it at that. But like I said, there are some artists that I just never found, they just stopped giving all the effort they had, you know, and then some of them just kind of, it's not as cruel as what I'm sounding like, but sometimes they kind of get comfortable and go through the motions, you know.
So getting back to music, do you think after the Beatles, Paul McCartney started phoning him in?
No, I don't think he phones them in, but I think Paul McCartney is just that he doesn't listen to anybody. He's just constantly doing things the way he wants to do them, and he doesn't have anybody saying, look, maybe you might want to change this or add this, or he doesn't collaborate with anybody. You know, I mean, that's a fine example of the same thing. I don't really care for the stuff he does, you know. He's another one that got comfortable. You know, and he's just knocking them out. He needed somebody else to...
You know, I don't think people like Frazetta or Kaluta or some of those, or Wrightson, even Jones phoned them in. I think they got older maybe. Wrightson's work changed.
Yeah.
But I don't think Kaluta and all and some of those guys ever phoned it in.
No.
I think whatever the word is, that's not the right word. I think they always kept their style and they kept advancing.
Yeah.
But maybe they were more artists than comic book guys, you know?
Well, Michael Kaluta has his own way of doing things. And there's certain things that you can always tell that's him. He has those elaborate designs, you know, and the serpent kind of things going on. But every time he draws them, I'm like, oh, look at that. It's like he's trying to draw for himself. You know, he's trying to make him happy.
Yeah, he's an artist.
Yeah, but sometimes, I don't know, I want to say this. I guess if you're an artist and you're famous for drawing, say, Space Ghost, you know. Say if Space Ghost was a comic book and... You were the artist that drew it, and everybody knew you, Space Ghost, and you drew Space Ghost for 40 years. Okay, I'm going to draw another Space Ghost. You're not really drawing that for yourself anymore. You're just kind of, all right, Space Ghost got to be done, but maybe you've lost some interest in it. You said what you need to say on it, and you're still doing it because people are interested. I think that's it. I think sometimes they've kind of...
Lose interest.
Yeah, well, say lose interest, but you know, Steve Ditko, I say this, I think Steve Ditko, I think he was gradually not as good, but I don't think he ever lost interest. You know, he was self-publishing some of those things, and I would read about him. He was, that last Charlton book he did, Static. Was it Static?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I bought it. It wasn't as good as the older stuff, but you could see he was putting his heart and soul into it. And, you know, all through it, he'd have things, what do you think? You know, what is your ideas about this? You know, it was his beliefs he was putting on paper. You know, he was giving it everything he had. But, I don't know, I think when I say that, it was still neat. I bought it. I would have bought others if I'd seen it. But... I was looking at a man whose best work was in the past, you know, in my opinion.
Well, I'll tell you, my buddy sent me a couple of John Buscema. I think it's either Conan. I think it was Conan layouts. I'm not sure if these were the ones he actually gave to anchors, but my God, they were so loose.
Yeah.
I mean, when I looked at it, I go, wow, these anchors really did an incredible job on his work, because he was, these are just like roughs, you know. And I think, you know, that's that happens too when you're on a deadline and Marvel wants you to do more work, especially with like Sal, you know. But this John Buscema stuff was loosey-goosey, man. I'm like, wow, okay.
I've got
hopefully
it.
Whoever did this issue, Alfred Alcala, had to do a lot of work on. I hope he got paid well.
I've got a couple of those. I was at a convention in Dallas, Texas, and Britt, myself, and another friend, Rick, we all bought we were in an art contest, and we all won part of it. And one of the prizes was, there were John Buscema Tarzan layouts. And they were on sketch paper. But basically, he broke the story down on sketch paper, and it was basically full-size comic page on sketch paper. Uh-huh. And it was Tarzan. And like you said, they were loose, but what amazed me was it wasn't like sketchy. I mean, they were sketchy, but it was just one pencil line. He drew the figure. I remember the one I had, Tarzan's in water, like sneaking up on something. And I was in college at the time, and I was showing it to another guy I went to school with. Oh, these are really nice layouts. And a senior student came in, and he looked at them, and he just kind of had this smirk. He goes, is this the guy that drew Conan? Well, yeah, he did draw Conan. It was John Buscema. But you can look at it two ways. It was a man so familiar with what he was doing, he'd just make a few panels as he read the script, sketch something out. Like I said, I think they were just breakdowns. I don't think those are the finishes. I think
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Didn't Tarzan, didn't he ink those himself? Do you know?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
So I think he just light boxed those on the Bristol board and then, you know, finished them.
I still got them. I'll send you, I'll post them on there. You know, I don't even, again, I don't know if these were the, what he gave to an inker, but my God, you know, I mean, you know, I remember seeing, I don't have these, so I don't even ask me for them. I don't even have them. But I remember years ago, Butch Geist inked some Ditko ROM, and I remember seeing some pencils, and they were just, they were drawn, but they didn't have any shading or anything like that. So he was basically leaving it up to the inker to do, you know, heavy lifting. You know what I mean? But when you're Steve Ditko, you'll get paid to do that because they want you. You know, they wanted Steve Ditko to come back to Marvel, so he did it, and he gave the effort that he had to, and then, you know, it was like, okay, fine, you know, great. We'll get some other guys to do it. So I think in Marvel in the 80s, they really did a lot of embellishing, maybe in the 70s too, on artist's work. You know, nowadays it's a different story, I think. Nowadays the artists do finished pencils for the most part.
Some
I don't
of
see
them.
Too much.
Some of them, I think the colorists finish some of it. It depends on who it is. I think what we're talking about, though, like in this, you just mentioned Steve Ditko, I guess that's sometimes people become a signature.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I like Carlos Santana. I like his early work. I think that some of the stuff is second to none, you know.
Yeah.
But then in the 90s, he started putting stuff out. It was fine, but basically it's, let's put this album out. Let's get Carlos Santana's signature sound, you know. And, you know, a friend of mine would bring in these CDs, and he held his guest artist on each song. And you'd have rappers going, I'm on a record with Carlos Santana, you know, and then, you know, he'd play a little part. That's how, it wasn't the whole musicianship where they're all trying to play and progress. It's just a signature sound, and that's how I kind of see it is, by this time, Steve Ditko was the, you know, Spider-Man artist. He was the guy that came up with Doctor Strange. He was the one that came up with all these visual worlds that expanded everybody. It was greatness. And after, well, let's see if we can get Steve Ditko on it. Well, of course, he's good. He's Steve Ditko. Well, it's not quite the same, you know.
No.
That's all I'm saying. But there are some. I don't think Joe Kubert ever turned into that all the way to the end.
Yeah.
I mean, saying that.
He had a loose style, though, but yeah.
Yeah, he had a loose style, but, you know, that's
so strong all the way to the end, yeah.
I was shocked when I found that Sergeant Rock, The Prophecy. I gave you an issue I found at a dollar box. He was always really creative. Everybody thinks of him as that rough, sketchy style, you know, which is true. But he had really sophisticated layouts and storytelling techniques. That's what always amazed me. And on The Prophecy, he still drew like he did, but it was a simpler way, but the forms and the thought was still there. He was always progressing. Joe Kubert, you never, ever stop being good, and that's the highest thing I can say to you, and you accomplished a lot in your life. Mobius, I think, was the same way. He never stopped being good. Some of the second books Dark Horse put out, I think it's called Inside Mobius. I didn't buy it. Mark Chure bought it, and he said he was kind of questioning it. I found it an odd choice to be the second book that Dark Horse is putting out when everybody's waiting for Mobius' work. It's kind of like cartoony things of himself. Well, I mean, they're good. I look at them, like seeing them. I don't really want to buy it, but they're good. They're just not the Mobius work. But he still drew some of those same stories to the day he died, and I'm thinking, how is he doing this? The Hernandez brothers are two younger brothers, but I mean, they're, I think Gilbert's in his 60s. I think Jaime is getting close to 60, you know. They haven't stopped being good, you know.
Gilbert's style seems simpler than it used to be.
Yeah, he's, well, Jaime stripped his down, but it's a thought process, like an Alex Poe thinking. Steve Rude's another one. He's never stopped being good.
No. Rude's always, yeah.
And every time I see his work, I snag it. I mean, the painted covers, the line drawings, which is my favorite.
Yeah. He became Andrew Loomis.
Yeah. Andrew Loomis and Dr. Seuss, Alex Toth and Jack Kirby all rolled into one person.
Yeah.
But
he's a genius guy. He's a little crazy, but he's a genius guy. Yeah, no doubt.
It takes a village, you know. Anyway.
Sometimes it takes a village idiot, but that's a whole different story.
Yeah. That's why they keep
anyway. Well, you got anything else on your plate there, man?
We've talked a long time. This is going to be a long time download show.
So, okay. No problem.
So, anything else you want to say?
No, that's it. We've said all we can for now. We'll be back soon with more ramblings.
There you go. One of the things, to the people that send in comic covers, you know, for the Facebook page, thank you very much. If you would like to do one, you can see the dimensions on the two-dimension page. We have a page called Comic Covers. Just look at one of those, use the dimensions of it, send in a cover. I can add the text to it if you want to. Al's done a few. This episode's going to have it's going to have Roddy Frey.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right.
But that's it. I'm out after that. So if you have a cover and you're thinking, I don't know if I want to send it to us. We'd love it. And if it's okay, if you do send it to us, we will put it on the page if you tell us it's okay.
Anyway, unless it's dirty.
If it's dirty, I'll just send it to Al for his personal enjoyment.
If it's dirty, we'll just put two little black boxes in the bad parts and, you know.
Because I'm out, and I'm in trouble, so somebody's got to come up with something.
I'll work on another one for you, just in case.
That would be beautiful. A lot of compliments on yours. As a matter of fact, this last episode we posted...
the Barbara Steele one?
I love that one.
From Black Sunday, yeah.
And what was it, Dan Pritchard, he said... what was it? Let me find this here. Dan Pritchard said... on the cover, it was just a joke, but hang on, it's taking me a second.
Yeah, I had to get a Barbara Steele drawing in there.
That was fun. That was nice. Well, they were all nice, but I really enjoyed that one. But come on.
Is Dan Pritchard still doing Slice Radio?
It's there. He's doing it, but he had to drop the whole bringing in the comedians, all this stuff. He picks things up and stuff, but it's still there.
Okay. He was doing comedians for a while.
Yeah. Yeah, we talked about it in episode 202 again. Oh, here's what Dan said. That lady, evil or sick? And I said,
Black Sunday, man. That's a great movie. I tell everybody to go watch that classic Mario Bava movie, Black Sunday.
I'm going to write that. Al says it is from... the movie
Black Sunday.
Hey, come on. Why isn't this?
Directed by Mario Bava, starring Barbara Steele.
Black.
Bava, B-A-V-A, and Steele, S-T-E-E-L-E.
I'm just going to put movie Black Sunday. I'm tired of typing.
All right. You got it.
But, Slice Radio is still a thing, but it's not the thing that we knew, but I think he's wanting to do that again at some point.
That'll be cool.
He's still active on everything. So, all right. I guess that's about all we got. If you have any questions or suggestions, send them in to us. The contact is on the blog. And in the meantime,
read
more
comics. And if you have any suggestions, once again, I say, like I said before, make them clean, okay? No bad suggestions. Don't tell us to do something, you know what I mean? Just make it nice and clean. Same with the artwork.
Oh, there you go.
That's all.
Good job. Bye.